The following Aloud podcast was recorded live in 2008 at the historic Central Library in the heart of downtown LA as part of the award-winning Aloud series presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Aloud podcasts are made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arent Fox and by individual contributions from listeners like you. For more information on Aloud, or to find out how you, too, can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please visit our website, www.aloudla.org. Gina Nahai will be here with her marvelous book to talk with Robert Scheer. Lucette Lagnado was not able to come due to health reasons, and I think we will have a fantastic program tonight. Gina Nahai is the author of four novels, including Cry of the Peacock, Moonlight on the Avenue of Faith, which was a finalist for the Orange Prize in England and the Impact Award in Dublin, and Sunday Silence. Her novels have been translated into 16 languages, and her writing appears in many publications. She's a former consultant for the RAND Corporation. She studied the politics of pre- and post-revolutionary Iran for the U.S. Department of Defense. She teaches creative writing now at USC, and she's also a frequent lecturer on the contemporary politics of the Middle East. Gina's newest novel, Caspian Rain, set in the tenuous decade before the Islamic Revolution in Iran, is both a riveting family drama and compelling historical fiction. Her heroine, 12-year-old Yas, is born into a divided family. Her father is the son of wealthy Iranian Jews who are integrated into the country's upper class, mostly Muslim elite, and her mother was raised in the slums of South Tehran, one street away from the old Jewish ghetto. Library Journal praised the book as richly detailed, emotionally intense, and tremendously moving. Tonight, Gina and Bob will be discussing The Enigma of Iran, or Why American Policymakers Should Read More Fiction, which I think is a really interesting thing to think about. Robert Scheer is editor-in-chief of the political blog truthdig.com, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with, and the author of seven books, including Thinking Tuna Fish, Talking Death, Essays on the Pornography of Power, With Enough Shovels, Reagan, Bush, and Nuclear War, and America After Nixon, The Age of Multinationals. With his son Christopher, The Five Biggest Lies Bush Told Us About Iraq, and most recently he wrote Playing President, My Close Encounters with Nixon, Carter, Bush, and Clinton, How They Did Not Prepare Me for George W. Bush. Between 1964 and 69, he was Vietnam correspondent, managing editor, and editor-in-chief of Ramparts. From 76 to 93, he served as national correspondent for the LA Times, and he can be heard on our media sponsor, KCRW, 89.9 FM, on the political radio program Left, Right, and Center. And Bob will be back here on the Aloud stage on June 12th to discuss his forthcoming book, The Pornography of Power, How Defense Hawks Hijacked 9/11 and Weakened America with John W. Dean, author and former White House counsel. Before we start, just a note about the format. Gina and Bob will be in conversation tonight. Then we will open it up to your questions. Justin will be going around with the microphone. We ask that you wait until the microphone comes to you because we do record for podcast. Our podcast page is up and we are adding to it all the time. So check out our website and go to the podcast page. Please turn off your cell phones and pagers. Gina will be signing her books afterwards in the lobby, courtesy of the library store. So please welcome Gina Nahai and Robert Scheer to the LA Public Library.
So, how you doing? Did we just begin? Is that it?
Say that again?
We just start like that? Okay.
Yeah.
Let me just say something. I was going to be very poorly prepared. I was a late substitute, and I had my own book due last night. I had to get on Federal Express to get the corrected page proofs into New York. And so I was feeling very guilty, but I thought, I can't possibly show up here without having read the book. And to my delight, I finished it. And in one day. And I found it terrific. So I'm now unencumbered by any sense of guilt or anything. I really do think it's a marvelous book. It's obviously a very fast read, yet it's worth the $25 or whatever it is because it's just full of a lot of material. And I'd like to take the title seriously that we were given. And I just want to mention, the woman who cuts my hair left for Vietnam on Tuesday. I was very sad. And she had
in June, he's going to have long hair.
And she had been a boat person. And it turned out, and I had been in Vietnam, actually almost before she was born, and I'd been there a lot. And we talked a lot. She had worked for the American Embassy. And so over the years, came to be that I got about 80% or 90% of my information about what was going on in Vietnam from the woman who cut my hair. And I bring it up only because most of America lost interest in that country once we weren't invading it or attacking it or something. And we have really no sense of the complexity of other people's history, who they are, and so forth. So when I saw the title, the topic, it struck me as really appropriate that, you know, we as a people, we don't tend to travel very much. We tend to be a bit arrogant about other countries. So I take it seriously. And I think if one wants to discuss what's going on now in the Mideast, in Iran, I wrote a column this week pointing out that for the first time, a head of state has visited what we call liberated Iraq, and he happens to come from Iran, and that, in fact, the Ayatollahs have greater power now than they've ever had in the Mideast. And you would have kind of known something about all this if you read this book. And you would be introduced to a great deal of the complexity of foreign governments involved, because here this is a book that deals with the period just before the Shah is overthrown and the Ayatollahs come into power. You deal with a lot of the contradictions of society. One of the things I love about this book, and I'll get around to a question in a minute. But one of the things I love about this book, there's an incredible sense of something that we Americans never talk about, which is class. And we always assume that anything else, gender or religion, trumps class in every case. And in this book, there's an enormous class tension, and not just class tension in general society, but within Jewish society in Iran. It's actually the overriding tension, I think. I may be misreading the book, but the attitude of wealthier Jews towards the poorer Jews living in the ghetto and so forth, and how that informs attitudes about everything and how it tears apart this marriage, or actually sets up a marriage that would not work. And it just struck me as fresh in a way to be reminded that class matters. To be reminded that all of these religions, or at least the two that are discussed in this book, are complex and not always rewarding. You know, because these days it's very fashionable to put down the Muslim religion. But when one reads about how Jewish people were living, and one of the points, and maybe I'll begin with asking you a question about that, because you were talking about it just before, you know, that this a lot about the Jewish religion was not so wonderfully appealing, or the experience of Jews in the old days. And so let me just begin by that. How do people, first, I know back there you said it really hasn't changed.
Things haven't changed. Well,
even though you've come to this country, you came here when you were 13.
Well, here's the thing. First of all, about religion, what I found, I came here to this country in 1977. I actually arrived the night Elvis died. And it says a lot, I think, about the kind of shadow that America cast over Iran, that we woke up in the morning and heard that Elvis had died, and we were devastated. And it was like, these immigrants, what the hell do you care why Elvis died? And the other thing that it says is that my mother to this day remembers where she was when JFK got shot. She doesn't remember where she was when the Shah got shot, or she doesn't remember where she was when anything else happened, but the JFK assassination she remembers. So that's how aware we were of what goes on in this country and how fascinated we were by it. So that, of course, has nothing to do with your question. But what I observed back then, and I've still noticed, is that at its extremes, every religion is very similar to the others, and that this country, for instance, is a deeply religious country, and at its extremes, it's very similar, the religion here is very similar to extreme Islam and also extreme Judaism. The only difference, I think, for Jews has been over time that the population is small, and so we haven't had the kind of shadow that the Muslim world can cast or Christianity can cast. I think fundamentalism has there's certain traits that all fundamentalists share, and they're very similar to each other. Americans often don't like to hear this. the book that I wrote before this one, Sunday Silence, deals with this whole question of fundamentalism in this country. And I used to go around talking to audiences, and American audiences would glaze over when I'd bring up the fact that there is fundamentalism in this country, too.
Yeah, but so let me repeat the question.
Because, I'm so sorry.
I think what you said is very interesting, and in fact, that was going to be my second question. So let me drop my first question.
Repeat the question.
Okay. All right, the first question was something you said back there that I thought was interesting.
Let me
say my prejudice on this. You know, we at the time of the first Gulf War, it turns out there was something like 8 people in the State Department that knew Farsi. I think there were 6 or 7 that knew classical Arabic or so forth. So I used to go around saying there's more than that in a Starbucks in Westwood. than in the State Department. And in fact, we have in our community, and I know this from writing my local columns for the LA Times and so forth, that we have this vibrant Persian community, both Muslim and Jewish, and that it's incredibly complex. And every time I would write about this community, whether it was jumping over the fires at New Year's or what have you, I'd get all of this thing. And in fact, reading this book, I was reminded of a scene we had together, because I had a young Persian student at USC, where I also teach, and working with me, and I was invited to her wedding, and showed up. My wife was yelling at me all the way there because it was called for 9 o'clock, and we're going to be late, and we had some idea, some waspy wedding where, you know, the minister is there and you walk in late, and it's very embarrassing. And we get there, and we are a little bit late, and there was no one there. No one, absolutely no one. And we wait around for another hour thinking we're in the wrong place. And then we run into Gina, and she says, "Oh, you fool, you didn't know a Persian wedding."
Not only that, they were the only 2 white people. It was like 1,000 people there, and Bob and Nada were the only 2 white people. Which, you know, okay, I remember your first question now. Here's the thing, what I've observed.
Well, I just was going to say, in the book, there's a lot of discussion about how the dinners start at 10, 11 o'clock at night, and the recognition that is indeed a very different culture.
A very different culture. But what's happened over here is that we've been here, the majority of us, I've been here longer, but the majority of us have been here 25, 27 years. And in many ways, we've integrated a great deal in the larger community, in the sense of educationally, professionally, artistically. And yet, what I've learned, especially since I started talking about, you know, going around for this book, is that for the most fundamental traits, social traits that we brought with us 25, 30 years ago, that we have not changed a whole lot at all. And that in many ways we're raising our children with the same kind of values that we escaped from. I mean, religiously, for instance, Iranian Jews have become, they escaped a fundamentalist country and they came out here and they have all this freedom, and what have they done? Most of them have become much more religious. They've embraced Orthodox Judaism, which we didn't have in Iran, and they've become a lot more religious. The division between Iranian Jews and Iranian Muslims has widened that gap, and so it's really interesting, what is it about that culture that has such a strong pull, or what is it about this culture that allows the growth of all these little mini cultures without integrating.
Right, but you're also unsparing in your evaluation of this culture, because there's a tendency always to think about the wonderful innocence of the old country. And I know my Jewish mother would disabuse me of that and describe it, life in the shtetl, as an absolute horror.
Oh, yeah, no, I have no thought that it was great. I think the best thing that happened to us by far as a people, and we've been in Iran for over 3,000 years, the best thing that happened to us was the revolution and the fact that people were forced to leave a place that they wouldn't have left otherwise. But no, I don't, and I'm always talking about how Iranians tend to idealize life under the Shah, and a lot of that is in this book. The kind of fear that we had before you started school, that one of the first things before kindergarten that you were taught is, don't open your mouth to say anything with the word Shah in it. Do not say. And if people ask you, don't say, because 1 out of every 3 people in Tehran was supposed to be an informant, even little kids. So that's the atmosphere we lived under back then. Things have gotten worse, true, but they weren't very good then either.
Yeah, you know, and one of the things you do get sort of a little bit into is the role of foreigners in the history of Iran. And in the case of the Shah, as you mentioned in the book, you say, at least your character says, he was good for the Jews.
Mm.
I think his secret police Savak was even in some ways influenced or trained by Israelis.
Yeah.
And the U.S. certainly played a key role in the overthrow of Mossadegh and in the installing of the Shah. How is that affected the future history? I mean, the
overthrow?
And the whole continuing estrangement of Iran. Because I just, another little anecdotal note. I remember when the Shah was in power, because I actually interviewed him at one point. Mm. And I remember at that time, your typical Iranian or Persian student in an American college was against the Shah, even if their parents were in the government. They were against the Shah. I think the expression that they had at their rallies, Magda Shah, it was death to the Shah. But they didn't expect religious fundamentalism. Most of them, I never met one of them that expected the religious fundamentalists to come in after, like the Ayatollah. They expected there would be a flowering of democracy.
You know something? No, they didn't. What most of those students wanted something a lot closer to communism, and they used to call it Islamic socialism. You know, that's kind of withered away. But no, the fundamentalists don't want democracy. Those students didn't want democracy. There really is hardly anyone, even right now, agitating that actually wants democracy. Even those students right now, you know, in the democracy movement in Iran, their idea of democracy is very different from ours. You know, it's the kind of situation where you give them one election and they're going to elect a tyrant. Either it's a religious tyrant or it's a more socialist tyrant. They'll elect a tyrant that's going to rule over them for the next 40 years.
Why?
Why do they want to do that? Well, I think, look, this whole idea of democracy and equal rights and, you know, women's rights and all of that is a very new concept, right? And you cannot be a country that's as deeply religious as Iran, for the most part, right? And that wants to still hold on to those tenets, even if they don't talk about integrating to the government. A country like that is not going to be able to go far enough, fast enough from that way of living to actually want this sort of the kind of democracy that we think about in this country. You know, I mean, it's patronizing and wrong to say that it's too soon in certain countries to actually try to bring democracy. But I do think that in some ways things change a hell of a lot more slowly over there, and that a little bit of change every 2 decades, a little bit of change for the better is all that you can hope for. The sudden shift from the regimes that we've had up till now, all of a sudden into a real pluralistic society, that's going to be devastating.
Let me ask you about the role of nationalism and imperial powers, because you mentioned this in your book, the English and Italians and the Americans, And in that connection, so clearly there's been, even the Shah himself became more of a nationalist towards the end and was rallying OPEC and raising the price of oil. But in your book, you say that Persians hate Arabs, or at least you have a character who says that.
Oh, no, we hated Arabs, and we actually felt so superior to Arabs. It was like Persian being called an Arab is still a big
right.
insult.
So in your book, there's a very harsh view from your characters of Arabs. On the other hand, the people who now are in power in Iraq were living in exile in Iran, and they just received the president of Iran in a very call me uncle Jamal, whatever his name is, and kissing and handshaking and everything. Has the United States unified Iran with the Arabs? Has it brought about? I mean, is it? Here was Iraq and Iran were at war.
No, I think those you know something? You and I once had this conversation. The thing about the Middle East is 2 + 2 don't add up to 4 in that country. They really don't. And so one of the enigmas about Iran is this, that we are a country, we're a people who feel very deeply that the culture of original Iran, you know, Iranians were in the region long before there was an Islam, and that part of our identity we take really seriously and we feel very deeply. And at the same time, it's a country that 97% Shiite Muslim, and of that 97%, I would say easily 90% is very seriously fundamentally Muslim. And so they feel this sense of kinship perhaps with other Shiites, but that's sort of one of these things that you nudge it a little bit and it's going to fall over. That war that they had between Iran and Iraq that went on for 8 years, the whole thing that the mullahs kept calling is, you know, the Arabs want to invade, the Arabs want to kill us, and that was enough. And then there's the whole, between Shiites and Sunnis, there's this whole concept of ritual impurity that also divides
but
them.
But if you could put on your RAND Corporation hat for a minute. I mean, we have this situation that no one would have predicted as a result of the invasion of Iraq. Which
you actually predicted it yourself?
I know I did. Yeah? But I mean, the mainstream media didn't predict
Bob's
it.
Bob's always right.
I'm just being modest there, yes. But seriously, I did not predict this incredible expansion of the power of the Ayatollahs, which is now in Lebanon, you know, is now in Gaza, it's now in Iraq. They have become the dominant power. And I just wonder whether who where are they getting the advice from? Back when we were talking, you're saying, you know, who are the people who, going to our theme, should you listen to a novelist or listen to a so-called expert? I know, like, for instance, Pollock, who wrote this latest book on the Iranian thing, he doesn't even speak Farsi, I gathered, or read it. But, I mean, how could we have predicted this? Where should we get insight into this part of the region?
You know, you could have predicted it if you'd asked any normal person, Iranian person at Starbucks in Westwood, who didn't have a vested interest in things turning out one way or another. You know, we used to talk about this. Honestly, Bob was like screaming this from the rooftops that you're basically handing the country over to the mullahs in Iran. But the Iranians here, we used to talk about this, and we used to say, well, what's going to happen is they're going to go in there, overthrow Saddam, hell's going to break loose, they're going to hand the country, Iraq, over to the mullahs. Not necessarily to the Iranian population, but to the mullahs. And that's going to go on for a while until the U.S. finds a tyrant more bloody and more cruel than Saddam, and I'm not kidding, installs him in there as a counterweight to the power of the mullahs and gets the hell out. And I promise you that's still what's going to happen. Because we can't leave Iraq in the hands of the Ayatollahs. And their power, I mean, they're just so infiltrated the country already that without them, there's not much that the U.S. can do. So the only thing they can do is to recreate that balance of power by putting somebody else who's going to kill more Iraqis than Saddam did.
Okay, we're going to run out of time, so I have a whole series of questions.
I
want to get off to politics. I'm the one that's been wasting the time. One of the things, when I've tried to read your books previously, it's been difficult because my wife always steals them from me. And in fact, we even had an experience, I forget what book festival, in Palm Springs or something. You remember? You had an author's delight. You probably don't remember. But you asked me, where's your wife? And I said, oh, she's in the car. Let's go say hello. And Narda was reading your book.
Oh, that's because...
She wasn't reading my book. She was reading your book. I think that your book deals with universal issues, universal themes. This is go way beyond Iran. And in this particular book, there's a really wonderful, nuanced discussion of women.
Mm.
And women and girls' relation to their mothers and how women are perceived and so forth. I don't know if you have a passage you want to read about that or you want to discuss it a little bit. But you were mentioning back there that with the Persian community here in the United States, that a lot of that persists, you know, arranging the marriage or how you see yourself as a woman. And so
yeah, the curse of femalehood. You know, this always fascinated me when I was growing up in Iran, number one, why were women who themselves had been so oppressed, as they got older, tended to oppress the younger women? You know, and that happens not just in Iran, in most traditional societies. I mean, in Afghanistan, there are hospitals just for the young girls who've been self-immolated and survived, out of the frustration of the tyranny of the mothers-in-law, right? And you think, well, these mothers-in-law were once the young girls, and how come that cruelty is exercised again? Or what happens in this book is that the mother doesn't show affection to the daughter because she's never seen it from her own mother, yes, but also because she's trying to protect the daughter against the disillusionment of what's going to happen later on as she grows up and she enters a marriage in which demanding affection is a mistake. And so this, you know, I've been fascinated by what women do to each other and the kinds of cruelties that minorities do to each other. And you see it even in this country, you know, like the shooting that we had, a Hispanic gang, an African-American gang, and they're shooting each other instead of uniting. Finally, I realized the thing is, a society that's oppressed exercises power only through oppressing someone who's weaker. And it's and a person who's oppressed can also exercise that power by someone else. And so that happens among women a lot. And I think, obviously it's one of the reasons that the women's movement has suffered. But I think that to a great extent it also happens in this country and in more enlightened countries, women resenting other women for the wrong reasons.
Well, then let me also throw it back into a Jewish context. Mm-hmm. Because again, we like to say, or not we, but the conventional view now is, oh, the Muslim fundamentalists, they're very primitive and so forth. Mm. And I remember, because I actually once married a woman who was an Orthodox Jew, so I went through that whole experience. And I found it extremely primitive and oppressive. Not that my first wife was bad in any way, but I mean the whole family structure and again the class thing. I mean, yeah. She was from the poorest side. In fact, it's no secret her brother Kenny Turan is the film critic of the LA Times.
Yes.
A marvelous fellow, and he was my brother-in-law, but he grew up in that environment. And when I was reading your book, it reminded me of Brooklyn of that time, of these Orthodox Jews, and yet, you know, that wasn't unifying. It was actually, being Jewish was not a unifying label. Because if you were out in Long Island, you looked down at the Jews who were in Brownsville, and your book is so textured in that way. It's the only way I can describe it. They come to the house and the contempt that is shown with almost every phrase.
Well, it's all about intolerance, and yeah, believe me, Jews are as intolerant as if you let them. You know, we can be as intolerant and as dictatorial as anyone. Absolutely. You know, what's happened in the Iranian community here is that the younger people have all become Orthodox. And there's this division within the family. Kids won't go to their parents' house because the house isn't kosher enough. Seriously, they won't even go there. You know, I have a cousin who's got triplets, and the kids aren't allowed to go into the parents' house because, they're like 6 months old. God forbid something unkosher goes into the little baby's mouth. And we didn't even have any of this. So we learned this intolerance in this country only because of this little subculture of more Orthodox, Jews, the Hasidic section. So Jews are intolerant, and we can be as cruel to each other as the next person.
So how do you escape all this, and why does your husband put up with it?
My husband put up with what?
Your independence. You're the new woman.
Oh, I know, yeah. Well, partly...
By the way, her husband runs the Department of Water and Power. If you have any trouble at all with your electricity or anything, David's the guy you got to go
see. And if your rates are being raised, you can yell at him. But he did refuse to cancel that lactation program. I don't know if you guys followed that or not. They were yelling that, why are you spending... Anyway, never mind.
How could you trace your own development? Okay, so you're a 13-year-old kid in Tehran.
No, this is why I escaped it. I had a very strange family, which it makes for great novels, great material. I had three grandmothers. I had one on my mother's side who was very kosher. You know, they were Lubavitchers who'd settled in Iran, and they were seriously Jewish. And one of them, the grandfather was a rabbi. And then my father's father had two wives, and one was a real kosher Jew, and one was a French Catholic who came to Iran not speaking a word of Farsi. She was very Catholic. She used to sleep, and we all lived in the same house. So if you've read Moonlight on the Avenue of Faith, that's the house. And so my grandfather and the kosher wife lived on the first floor, and the French grandmother, the Catholic grandmother, lived on the second floor, and she slept under this huge statue of Christ bleeding on the cross. And all we heard about was how Jews are Christ killers, and that but for Jews, none of this would have happened. And then we lived on the third floor. So, I don't know. I mean, I need a lot of psychoanalysis. Sometimes... I swear I'm not kidding. There's so many times people will come up to me and give me their business card and they say we should talk, and I look and they're like some kind of therapist or something because they read the books. But so we were always so outside of the norm anyway that none of it made sense to us. Which is a good thing. You get to, you know, you're kind of not part of the fun crowd, but you get to observe stuff that other people may not notice.
But you say fun crowd. I mean, you know, your book is not gloomy. I don't want to get anyone not to buy this book. It's a very cheerful.
It's cheerful.
Cheerful. No, it is. It's very.
You just want to hang yourself by halfway through.
But when you describe the ordinary cruelty of life, of one to the other, sister to brother, contempt to father, I mean, it. You know, it's. You wonder why people went on. I mean, there's. You know, it's the opposite of the image of the Jewish mother as loving and nurturing and warm.
Well, they were loving and nurturing and warm in their own way. But you know something? The reason I put the book in this era is that this is as good as it ever got for women in Iran and for women in that whole region. And as horrible as you're talking their lives were, that was as good as it ever got. And it was a hell of a lot better. You know, the mother's generation, Bahar's generation, did a hell of a lot better than her own mother's generation. Things were moving forward, but things move forward slowly over there, right? Okay, and so why did we go on? You know something? When you're living in something, that's the only reality you know, and there's no context with which to compare what else is possible. And we really had no idea until we came to this country about the possibilities of life being something other than what you had been born into, that your destiny is something that you've inherited. And, you know, we used to have these things in Iran called tear jars, and I write about it in the books, which were these glass bottles, all pretty painted glass bottles that everybody kept in their house, and at least the Jews. And at times of great sorrow, people would come to the house and cry into these jars, or you would cry into the jar, and then you'd save the tears. When your daughter got married, you'd give her the tears to take to her new house. Or if the sorrow was particularly grand, you would actually drink those tears. Yeah. So what does this say to you about the sort of, you know, the gloominess? And yet, you know, within that gloominess, there is happiness, because you don't know any different, you know? You haven't lived in L.A. to know what fun is.
Let me just ask you a question that's probably totally off the point. But I always thought that the Iranian people were a beautiful people, male and female. And the other day I saw a little thing, a documentary, that there are more nose jobs and other cosmetic surgery going on in Iran than anywhere. And that people who can't afford to have a nose job actually walk around with bandages pretending that they're having...
Oh, are you serious?
According to this series that I saw. So I raised this in my class at USC, where we have a bunch of kids. And they all said, yeah, that pressure's there. It's real. So what is it cultural imperialism? Is it, you know, as you point out...
You mean
this
the
is
nose job? Or?
Well, no, I'm talking about Iran now, not Israel. Is it a case of... Here is one of the oldest civilizations in the world. I mean, and then what happens? It runs up against modernization or other forces. And do they lose their sense of self? And is that one reason why they turn more to the Orthodox religions? Is this a rebellion against modernization?
Oh, you mean the ones who've come here and have...
No, I'm talking about even in Iran. You know, why would a 20-year-old... You know, scream for the Ayatollah, you know. Why wouldn't they embrace a more Western culture and so forth? Or is there a rebellion? Or why wouldn't they be happy with their noses? Why do they need different noses?
Well, I think the nose thing's different from the Ayatollah thing.
Okay.
I think. Although you could get a nose job and still scream for the Ayatollah. But I think those are two different things. But look, here's the thing. I actually, in the same place, I was in conversation with the woman who wrote Reading Lolita in Tehran, who was one of the people who screamed for the revolution and for the mullahs, and then sort of known better after. And I asked her, what were you guys thinking? And she said, I have no idea. This is the thing about youth. No, seriously. half the time they're screaming, but they don't know what they're advocating, and they don't know what they're bringing upon themselves. Now, that's like the easy answer, right? Why they do this. But I think the kind of cynicism that you get, people like me who have had a longer time to observe history, and so we realized with the time of the Ayatollah, the Shah, it wasn't good. It really wasn't. And I mean, I write about the Savak and everything that went on the Shah in all my books. That wasn't a good time. The only thing that we knew when we watched the revolution happen on television was that what's going to come after is going to be 10 times worse. Why? Because as Jews, we'd lived under the mullahs and under the tyranny of the mullahs. And so we knew that if these people take over the reins of the entire government, that they're going to turn that same tyranny that they exercised against the Jews for centuries against all their people. So that the biggest victims of the Iranian revolution actually are other Muslims, a lot of them the same people who advocated for that regime. I really think it has a lot to do with the fact that people don't study history and don't see how history repeats itself, and really a lot to do with the fact that people don't read my novels. I think if they did.
Let me push this a little. I don't know when we have to break, but somebody will give me a signal, I assume. Another 10 minutes? So we want to have a reading also. Okay, so let me defend my nose job question and
no.
A little further. I just, you know, like you have, okay, you have one view of what's going on in the world, say the Thomas Friedman view, which is we all should melt in, we all should become one and embrace modern consumer capitalism and we'd all be happier. And maybe that's true, but clearly there's a large number of people in the world who don't go down that road. In fact, they you know, at a time when the world was supposed to become one and the nation state was supposed to be over, suddenly we find old-fashioned ideas of nationalism and religion asserting themselves in very strong ways. And I just wonder, in the case of Iran, whether, well, first of all, there was an awful lot of meddling, and I know these students, when I interviewed them and knew them, they knew what they wanted. They wanted Mossadegh. They thought that the U.S. had intruded on their country, that they got this guy, the
Mossadegh
Shah.
Was just another tyrant, I have to tell you that. We just didn't get a chance.
We've had this discussion before, but yeah. I'm saying how they saw it.
Okay.
They saw it was a chance, and then the U.S. imposed something on them, and it all had to do with the nationalization of oil. I don't want to go into that. But when you look at these countries, you wonder what propels a person, even in Los Angeles, who then embraces Orthodox religion? It's clearly, in part, a rebellion against the market, modernization, the secular society, something. And I just wondered whether that isn't what fuels this drive. So now in Iran, for instance, you have this president who says, we are the center of the world. We're back.
Yeah.
You know, the Iranian empire
national
is
pride.
Back. Yeah. And it is appealing. And the counter thing seems to be a force that denigrates everything from your standard of beauty, your religion, what you have there. And that seems to be a major tension, whether we're whatever area, whether we're talking about Pakistan, we're talking about Lebanon, we're talking about Iran.
Yeah, it is a major tension. And the whole, you know, the complexity of Iran, a lot of it has to do with that in many ways we are a very, at least, pro-Western in many, many ways. All those people, those students, but also, you know, the people who are screaming on the streets for the mullahs, we do embrace a lot of Western, a lot of modern values. And at the same time, you say, you know, the call of religion or, you know, the Palestinian cause, and those same people will give up their life for that. So I think especially for Iranians, but you know what I think? I think that same sort, you know, that same tension can be the source of the beginning of an answer to what's going on, because I think Iran was where the problem, the whole Islamic fundamentalist movement started, and that's where all the problem that we have now, that's where they started it, these mullahs, and they're fueling it still. But I think the same way that it started there, it can the answer also lies in there, because of this affinity that Iranians have always had culturally with the West and with these Western values. And you say nose job and we laugh about it, but no, also the nose job factor. I think artistically Iranians are very open to Western values and and in many ways socially. And I really think the way to invade, you know, Victor Hugo said you can stop the invasion of an army, but you can't stop the invasion of an idea whose time has come. And I really think if you appeal to the nose job factor within the Iranians, you can win the general population over, but it takes years, it takes decades of slowly reaching for that and re-educating a whole population away from the fundamentalist.
Right, but you can have a counter trend which says, what's wrong with our noses? You know, what's wrong with the way we live? What's wrong with our traditions? And rebels in that way, and so I'm just throwing it out there.
Yeah, but no, we didn't. Look, no, but what I'm saying is that that counter trend is not strong enough, because at our core, Iranians, look, this is the country where the first Declaration of Human Rights ever was issued, right? I mean, long before there was a declaration, right? This and Iranians are very proud of that, Iranian Muslims and Iranian Jews and everyone. So at our core, there we have a lot of affinity for these sort of so-called Western values, not because it belongs to the West, but because we identify with a lot of that.
Let me, my final question, and this will seem even sillier than my previous ones.
Now, have any questions been previously silly?
Okay, but this is interesting, because when I was trying to cover the Persian community here to the degree that I did, I never could tell the Muslims and the Jews apart. I never knew.
Oh, yeah, but we can tell each other apart, like a mile
away. I know you can. It was, like, absolutely crazy. I would go to these parties. I remember, I think you were even, I went with Shirin. I mean, her best friend was Muslim, and we went there, and it seemed to be the same kind of house, eating the same food, same attitude, same oppressive mother-in-law or mother, what have you. And for the life of me, I could, without asking specifically, are we in a Muslim house or a Jewish house, I generally could not tell. And I couldn't tell when we would be at Starbucks. Mm. And I can't tell even now when I'm at USC. I don't know whether my students who are Persian by origin, or whether they're Muslims or Jewish. So how can you tell? And is there some possibility that actually these differences are not as great as we perceive? And that they could be.
Oh, yeah. I mean, look, there's a big possibility in many fundamental ways. There is very little difference between Iranian Jews and Muslims in many fundamental ways. But how can we tell each other apart? Like 10,000 little things. If you go to somebody's house, you definitely know by the cooking. Like, do they put, what is it, yellow lentils in the soup or don't? That, like, you know, that giveaway. Or do they, how much do
now,
they
which,
fry?
Which one do we want to do? We want yellow lentil?
Well, it depends which house you want to be in. But, you know, it's
come
the
on,
way...
Listen,
you can tell from the back. My kids are born and raised here, and they've hardly ever had even an Iranian friend, because they've gone to these schools where there are no Iranian kids, right? 6 miles away on the street, they can point out if that's an Iranian, and they know if it's an Iranian Jewish woman or an Iranian Muslim woman. How can you guys tell? Oh, the way she walks. Okay, how does she walk? When my daughter says, well, the Jewish women always look from the back like they're oppressed, even as they're walking on. Like going to Neiman Marcus on Wilshire Boulevard, as they go into Neiman to buy like the $3,000 Fendi bag, they still look oppressed, right? Whereas, I'm not kidding. And the Muslim women have, you know, better stature. And you know what? Better posture, I'm sorry. You know, we used to be told that, look, Iranian Jews, we wanted very much to sound and look and come across as Muslim, because for 1400 years we had been told that Jews are everything bad under the sun. And so your aspiration was, even though you wanted to stay Jewish, you wanted to look, you wanted to sort of pass as Muslim. And that was, you know, if somebody wanted to give you a compliment, still to this day, they'll say, oh, you don't look Jewish, you look Muslim. And that's supposed to be like a compliment. So one way, if she's prettier, she must be a Muslim. And sometimes the compliment now is, oh, you don't look Iranian at all. I'm always saying, is that like a good thing? But yeah, you just have to be there. You got to hang out with us a little more, and you'll.
I'll try. So, should we have questions now? Is that Any questions? Yes. Well, we need a mic with the question person. Yeah.
Wait.
Wow, tough crowd.
Gina, what was the reaction in the American, in the Persian community here to your, to the, this last book, in which the cruelties and demeaning of the poorer Persian Jews was so vivid, with passionate lyricism, Did you have a reaction by the people in the
community? It's really interesting. You know, I got all the flack for the earlier books. I think people are sick and tired of, like, even being mad at me, so they kind of ignore me. But
I would think they would be very mad at you.
No, I've got to tell you, it's really interesting. With this one, actually, I've had nothing but a lot. I mean, people have really embraced the story and the book. And a lot of the older women have said, this is exactly the way it was. And they're stunned at the recollection of what our life was like and our culture was like. And I've had a lot of Iranian sort of upper class Jewish women come up to me and say, actually a bunch of them this morning at one of these events, come up to me and say, you know what, when I read that seamstress scene, or when I read that hairdresser scene, all of a sudden I thought, my God, shame on us. Because they remember that, and they remember the snobbery, and they and it's one of these things that until you've re-experienced it from a distance, it doesn't really strike you as different. It's a way of life, and you've never questioned it, and you're not a particularly cruel person, but that's just the way things have always been, right? And then when they've read it, they're suddenly struck by the enormity of the cruelty. So with this one, it's actually been a lot smoother sailing.
Yes, it was very, very strong.
Yeah.
Narda? Is this your biggest fan?
Yeah.
By the way, Narda Zucchino is the person who deserves credit for starting the Los Angeles Times UCLA Book Festival. So,
really?
Thanks. Thank you. Bob is my biggest fan. Gina, can you talk about your book sales to other countries, and particularly with the story you told earlier about China?
Oh, I was talking about this. This happens a lot in sort of countries like Turkey and Greece and countries that are kind of borderline, a big Muslim population, right? Where somebody will buy the rights because the editor, the agent is not particularly concerned with anything but how much the book's going to make, right? So they'll buy the rights, and then afterwards in translation, they'll come back and say, oh my God, we can't publish this because, you know, in Turkey they threatened to cancel one of my contracts for Moonlight on the Avenue of Faith because I had actually mentioned genocide, right? One passage, one line, just one word, genocide. And so that was a big to-do. But with this one, the Chinese, they bought it in Taiwan, and they've been fine. But in China, they bought the rights, and at the same time, they bought the rights to all the other books. And then they came back, and they canceled the contract for this one, and they said, we don't want to publish a book that might offend Muslims at all. This is in China. And so it was back and forth saying there's nothing in, and they actually just withdrew their offer after they signed the papers and everything. And I kept saying there's nothing in this book that could offend Muslims. Well, we don't know, and we're not going to take a chance. And they had actually, they were talking with Khaled Hosseini, you know, Thousand Splendid Sons. They were talking about canceling the translation rights for that one. Also out of this concern. So finally I had to offer, well, I'm going to get a couple of Muslim scholars to read the book and tell you, you know, if they think this might offend Muslims. And they did, and, you know, it wasn't offensive. So that's why they put their offer back on the table. Just, you know, this is how intimidated I think the world is by, you know, this, you know, even in China, it was amazing.
Gina, I was curious about your comment about Mossadegh. From my history, it seemed that his only real crime was nationalizing English oil, which brought the United States in and subsequently overthrew him. And I was just wondering if you could add on to your comments about he was just as bad as the Shah.
Well, you know, I don't know. He didn't get the chance to show if he was just as bad as the Shah. And, you know, the Shah, for a while, he wasn't as bad as his father and so on. But this, the cult of the hero, you know, Dario Fo said, Italian playwright said, pity the nation that needs heroes. And this cult of the hero, of the single person who's going to come and save a country, and where all of your hopes and ambitions of the whole nation is vested in this one person, and that he's sort of riding alone and, you know, riding herd over everyone else. Mossadegh also was a product of that whole culture. And so given the chance, he would have centralized power, and he would have ruled just like any other dictator, I really think so. His crime to the West might have been that he nationalized the oil. That's why he was overthrown, true enough. But it doesn't mean that he was going to be, you know, rule for 4 years and then remove himself.
Yeah, well, his crime was, it was actually started with the Italian oil company that he nationalized, and then the British were afraid he was going to nationalize them. And he was a more secular leader, and he did have popular support. And I have to tell you, I don't want to get into a whole
so
big thing.
So did Khomeini have popular support?
I just want to tell you, this goes to something we haven't really discussed much, the role of our own country, but I happened to be at the LA Times when Narda was the weekend editor. We were married, and I was bothering her. I kept saying, when can we go eat? And she said, why don't you go do an interview or something? And I said, what do you mean? And she said, well, who do you want to interview? And I said, well, I'd like to interview Kermit Roosevelt, who overthrew Mossadegh. And she said, why don't you call him? I said, oh, you can't just call. She said, yeah, the phone books, this is before the, you know, internet and everything. She said, the phone books are over there. So she took me over to the Washington, D.C. Sure enough, his name was in the phone book. And the thing, guy was in a hospital. He had just had a serious operation. He was under drugs, but I identified myself. And I did a story for the Los Angeles Times. And he was very proud of it. How they went into the country and they just bribed everybody and threw all this money around and so forth and staged a coup against it. So whatever you think about Mossadegh, there's no question the United States overthrew him.
Oh, yeah.
Precisely because he was threatening Western oil interests. And that remains very vivid in the imagination of Iranians.
Oh, absolutely. Look, I mean, in one of my books, I actually have the scene where they hired a few people in Tehran and they gave them bills, actually, and they were handing out the money and saying whoever gets this, it was like 10 toman or something, very little money even, to go and say married by Mossadegh. So yeah, they actually literally paid people off.
Well, yeah, 25 that. Million in a sack is what he went in. In those days, it was considered quite a bit of money to buy
people. Well, I'm saying per person, it wasn't that much, but.
We need a mic over here. Are you going to read anything from the book, or is that we're going to run out of time? Or I think that's part of the
tradition. I can
here.
End, but yeah.
You said to be leery of the cult of the hero and one man. And with this election season, everyone's thinking that if we get rid of the one man who's caused so much trouble in the last 8 years, things are just automatically, our profile around the world will change.
Who is that, by the way?
Oh, who would that be? And his entire band of thieves. And so, in your opinion, do you think actually in Iran, if whoever gets in, that there will be an automatic improvement, or is that slightly naive or grossly naive?
No, I think it's going to be more of the same. I really do, because look, there's no credible alternative to the regime in Iran that is even slightly better. One good thing about the mullahs is that they have such vested interest. They're so entrenched. They've gotten so rich, and they've invested so much of the money in the West and over there that they actually have an interest in keeping the country half whole. Right? I mean, whole. And you know, they're running the place. You know, there's the trains are running and so on. Unlike Iraq. So, but the alternative to the regime of the mullahs in Iran, we have nothing. It's kind of like, you know, you have Chalabi for the Iraqis. I mean, that was laughable. We don't even have that in Iran. You know, people talk about, you know, the Shah's son, the young Shah. I don't even think he wants to go back. So, no, I think it'll get worse.
Do we have time for one more question? Or? Okay. There's one up there. Oh, you got to have a mic. I'll call you next. Okay, one, two. That'll do it.
Yes, might you mention what the relationship is likely to evolve into with Russia?
Between Iran and Russia?
Yes.
You know, Iranians, the biggest fear of Iranians after the British has always been the Russians. We think that the British are a hell of a lot more clever than the Russians, so they do things in a more underhanded way, but that the Russians, you know, they come full force, and, you know, they've kind of taken entire chunks of Iranian territory over time. So I think that that's always going to be a tense relationship in which they're watching each other, and I don't think there's going to be real closeness because Iranians realize how badly Russia wants to get down to the south and get to the water, you know, the Persian Gulf. And so in a way, I think Iran is a buffer against that sense of expansionism or potential.
I'd like to ask what your current contacts are with Iranians in Iran. I mean, if you have any.
Well, you mean me personally, or how much? Well,
yes,
you know,
you
I have
personally.
Relative, I have family who lives there, but the real contact is there's about altogether close to 30 Iranian television and radio stations, mostly in LA, but also on the East Coast and in Europe, that broadcast directly into Iran and that hear directly back. I mean, people actually call. And this goes on 24/7 all the time. And you change the channel and there's another one and another. Some of them are closed circuit and some are not. And so you have a very real sense. And forget, I mean, this is aside from what happens on the internet. So you have a very real sense of what's going on in the country because the communication is so open and ongoing.
You know, what you have, the reason I brought up the Vietnamese woman, Hoa, who cut my hair. I'll have to go now to South Vietnam to get it cut again. but it was interesting to me because people who are here at Starbucks from Iran care about Iran. And even if they weren't born there, but their parents were, they care about it. And that's what this woman had. She was able to read 10 or 12 newspapers on the internet and tell me there was a strike in this place, flooding here, this has happened, corruption here, and so forth. And what I resent most of all about our country's role in the world is we lose interest. We have very short attention span. We claim to be very interested in people's well-being and their freedom and democracy, and then we overthrow Mossadegh, and then we don't care, you know, for what happens in the next 15 years until they take some hostages of Americans. And so the same thing happened with Vietnam. And the irony is here, very large numbers of Vietnamese people now have gone back to Vietnam. And here's a woman who had worked for the U.S. Embassy, who was a boat person, who is now going to collect her Social Security check back there, and who has built her retirement home. And so I do think that I always found, talking to Gina and other people I knew in this community, that I could learn a great deal more about what was happening in Iran than by reading the New York Times or the LA Times or anything else, because there's a passion and a concern. And I want to say something else about this book that registered upon me. I wrote once a series on the Jews of LA, and I got in all kinds of trouble because, you know, people didn't like it and so on. And I've always thought about this question of this Jewishness and everything. And I remember I picked up a prejudice from my mother. And my mother was a seamstress in Lithuania, and she left when she was 21 and came to this country. So that's a long time to be a seamstress. And she also became something of a revolutionary and bomb thrower and everything else, but we'll leave that aside. But I remember my mother, and her great-grandfather was a big rabbi in Vilna and everything. And I remember my mother always stressing something that, and she would have loved your book, because she always stressed that, yes, even among the Jews, there's class. Mm. And that's what I find so incredibly powerful about this book. And just the little details of the contempt shown when you go into someone's house, or you wouldn't want to socialize with them, and so forth. And it's a reminder that we have differences within religions as well as between religions.
Oh, yeah.
So I just thought that, if for no other, I think there are many reasons to read this book, but if for no other reason, even if you don't care about Iran, you know, if you can just care about human nature and how we find things to lord over other people, this book is an incredibly powerful statement in that regard. So do you want to read some, maybe where
so
they
much.
Replace the carpets and all that?
I'm going to read just the opening. I'm going to tell you a little bit about the book, other than what Bob has said. It's the story of a young Iranian girl growing up in the years before the revolution who's losing her hearing. And she by the end of the toward the middle of the book, actually, she goes entirely deaf. And it's really a story about loss and the ways in which we dealt or deal with loss in more traditional societies as opposed to the ways in which Americans deal with loss. It was one of those other things other than religion that I was always fascinated by watching this country. I always think every novel starts with a question, and the question, the writer's reason for writing the book is to find the answer to that question. And for me, the question was, having been raised in Iran and having lived in this country for 30 years, what philosophy do I have about how do I deal with major loss in my life? Because this is the country of making lemonade out of lemons, and this is the country where in the Constitution you have life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, which is unheard of anywhere else. And in Iran, we had this culture in which your life was predetermined from birth, and a lot of that was the losses and the tragedies that you'd inherited from your parents, no matter what your life was. Anyway, so the mother in this story is a woman who believes that her luck will change and that she's going to reinvent herself by leaving her social class, and she's raised right outside the ghetto, and stepping into something, into a bigger world, and a world of greater possibility. So this is the very opening of the book, and the daughter is telling the story. She's 16 years old, a young woman in a city with blue mountains. She's walking to school with her books in her arms. She has on a faded gray uniform, a pale lipstick that she's had to hide from her parents and put on only after she's left the house. It's a golden spring morning, the light as clear as polished glass, the air imbued with the scent of poet's jasmine that blooms on slender vines everywhere in the city. The sun is just rising behind the tall maple trees that line both sides of the avenue of the departed, creating a gallery of light and shadows where the girl's image is by turns eclipsed and illuminated and eclipsed again, until she turns the corner onto the square of the Pearl Canyon and emerges into a sea of brightness. As she steps off the edge of the sidewalk, she feels a breeze, looks up in time to see a cloud of cherry blossoms rain down on her like a blessing. She lets out a cry of joy, opens her arms, and turns full circle amid the flowers. Her books fall to the ground and her papers fly into moving traffic, but she's laughing because she knows this is a good omen, a sign from the heavens that her luck has turned for the better. Any moment now, she thinks, Providence will sweep toward her with a flap of its giant wings, land on her shoulder, and transform her life. Once upon a time, in a land of miracles. When she looks down again, she's inches away from the shiny bumper of a car. A dark, angry man in a chauffeur's cap and uniform is leaning out the window and yelling that she should look where she's going, get herself killed under someone else's car, just don't mess up his tires. He doesn't frighten the girl at all. From where she's standing, she can see her own image reflected in the tinted black windshield, see the flowers that have been caught in her hair, in the folds of her skirt, on top of her books that lie around her feet. The driver is still livid. Hurry up and get off the road. You're holding up the bus. People have work to do. But instead of moving out of the way, the girl leans closer, peers through the glass at the passenger in the back seat. She's blocked the entire lane now, and cars are honking from every direction, but she takes her time picking up her books. God damn it, girl, you're just a kid. You have no business causing a nuisance for people bigger than yourself. Don't you know how to behave in civilized society? The driver yells again, but the answer is obvious. This is what my father sees as my mother stands before him that early spring morning in the city of my dreams. He sees a girl of limited means and abundant spirit. Of all the stories I will tell about my mother, this is the one I cherish most. I like to see her at the point of inception, the moment that would set the course for all our lives and all the stories that followed. And though I always know the end even before I've said the first word, I like the possibility, the promise inherent in each new telling of a different finish. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, I guess that's it. Thanks for coming, and thank you. Yes.
Oh, thank you. We had a good time.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.